Oh, it was incredibly simplified, Gideon countered, clearly taken aback. So, I'll wager those kids learned more just now than they ever have in any hours-long service. And I bet the same would be true for half the town if they'd heard what you just said. You're always saying you joined the heirs because you were searching for a purer, more direct way to connect to Euros. That seemed pretty direct. Oh, Tamsin, I know you mean well, but I didn't give up my old life, come all the way to Grashand, and study the finer points of philosophy and theology, just so I could deliver 10-minute lectures outside. We stopped near the forest's edge, giving us a good vantage on the playing children. As engaged as he was with me, he constantly kept an eye on them, and his genuine concern for them touched me. Satisfied they were okay, he continued. Have I ever told you what really drove me here? You said you were disillusioned in Osfro. He leaned against a tree, his gaze fixed on the plains beyond the children. Or maybe he was seeing the past. Yes, but my change of heart didn't just happen out of the blue. I don't like to talk about it much because it's embarrassing. I go on and on about people who are self-absorbed and obsessed with their own pleasures, but the thing is, I was one of them. I spent my parents' money on gaudy clothes and other nonsense. I went out to a different party every night, drinking myself silly. There were women that I... The familiar blush filled his cheeks. That's not really something to be discussed in front of a proper young lady. Long story short, I woke up one morning in the backyard of some house I didn't know, sick and dirty, with no money and no memory of the previous night. I'm not sure how I dragged myself home, but I passed out again when I got there. I was in and out of consciousness for a week, and when I finally stayed lucid, I learned I'd nearly died from a fever I caught sleeping outside, and that's when I knew I had to change. I reached for his hand, well aware there'd be all sorts of fallout if someone saw the gesture, but I couldn't help it, not when the anguish of his past burned so fervently in his eyes. It always seemed appropriate that his dazzling good looks were paired with a serene and affable attitude, so it was surprising that this raw moment almost enhanced his handsomeness. It made him real. Thank you for telling me that, Gideon, for trusting me enough to tell me that. I know how hard it is to talk about the darker parts of our pasts. Gideon lowered his eyes to our hands, studying them before he answered. Then you can see why I've worked so hard to fight through worldly distractions and immerse myself in the study of Euros, and why I need to get others to understand it too. I do see that, but I don't see what's so wrong with sharing your message in a way that's easier to grasp, even if, yes, it's simplified. If you really want them to understand, do the means matter? His pensiveness shifted back to amusement, brightening the mood around us. You see, this is why I need you, Tamsin. Not that I fully agree with that line of thinking yet, but I love that you do think about it. You know how to get through to people, and we could do amazing things to fulfill my dream. You're giving me too much credit. Again. Neither of us had spoken of his tacit proposal until now, largely because Vanessa had overshadowed it. And anyway, it's impossible. What if it isn't? He squeezed my hand and took a step closer. What if... His words were swallowed by a roar from the woods. It was our only warning before four men wrapped in brightly coloured plaid came charging out on horseback. Two held guns and two carried blades. All had blue paint streaked over their faces. They were riding toward a cluster of children, weapons aimed straight ahead. I wrenched my hand from Gideon's and tore off, diving in front of the kids as the riders skidded to a halt in the snow. Stumbling, I regained my balance and motioned the children even further behind me. Some screamed or whimpered. A few exclaimed, "Ikori! Ikori!" Ikori? Yes. I suppose these men did look like the Ikori in my textbooks, even down to the wild way their red and blonde hair had been teased to stand up. But it took me a moment to make the connection, because for the last few weeks, my mental images of the Ikori had been replaced by Orla and her friends, in their plain, practical leather and wool travelling clothing. The riders jumped off their horses and advanced on us, their weapons still poised and ready. I stayed where I was, making myself the first obstacle they'd meet. "What do you want?" I demanded.
You don't move, Asfridian girl," one ordered, raising a dagger to my throat.
His tartan shirt was ripped open at the front, exposing a chest also painted with blue woad. One of his companions began moving among the children scattered farther out, herding us together.
"Hold on now," said Gideon.
In my periphery, I saw him hurrying over to me.
"There's no need for hostilities. Our people are at peace."
An Ikori with red hair grabbed Gideon by the front of his coat and threw him down to the ground.
"No!"
I cried. I started to move toward him, but the blade stopped me. More gasps and screams came from the children. Leering, the Ikori man rested his booted foot on the side of Gideon's face, pushing it into the snow. Raw fear poured through me, not for myself, but for him and the children. My eyes scanned frantically around as I searched for a way to help.
"You have gold?" barked one of the men. "Give us gold."
The man whose blade was on me added,
"Give us gold. We no kill woman."
"I don't have any gold," Gideon said. "But if you'll let me stand, I'll give you what I do have." His assailant backed off, and Gideon slowly rose. They watched warily as he reached in his pockets, but all he brought out was a handful of mixed silver and copper coins. The red-haired man snatched them.
"More."
"That's all I've got," said Gideon. "I swear by Euros." The Ikori looked expectantly at me. "I don't have any money at all, and neither do they," I exclaimed, seeing one of the men eye the children.
"Is there something we can help you with?" asked Gideon. "Do you need food?"
The Ikori exchanged glances.
"Yes," said one. "Give us food. Give us other precious things."
Precious things? This lot apparently had no idea who they were robbing. The heirs of Euros weren't exactly the type to be walking around bedecked in silk and jewels. But at the Ikori's behest, we gathered up all of the children's school bags and then waited under the watchful eye of a gun-wielding man as the other three ransacked the pile. Gideon took a step nearer me, angling himself protectively between me and our assailants. The only food we had consisted of a few modest snacks sent by parents, and it was all immediately confiscated, as was anything of even meagre value. A steel canteen, a bag with a brass buckle, a hornbook made of beautifully carved cherry wood. When they finished with the bags, the Ikori examined our persons more closely. Objects made of fur, mufflers and hats were taken, along with anything metal that was bigger than a button. Belt buckles, cloak pins. Gideon and I made no moves to stop the Ikori, and continually assured the children that this would be over soon, that they only needed to be still and quiet, that no harm would come to us. This was undermined a bit by the Ikori, who took a perverse delight in sneering and growling at the children.
"Please," said Gideon, when the last child had been frisked. "You have everything now. Let us go. These are innocent children, and we just want peace."
The Ikori, who first accosted me, snorted.
"Only coward want peace."
But they did seem to be backing off. They readied their horses and bagged up the loot. A couple shivered and rubbed their arms. I dared to think this nightmare might be over when one Ikori noticed he'd missed a boy's fur-lined coat.
"Take off. Take off," ordered the Ikori.
He towered over everyone and had a thick, blonde beard. The boy froze, his face turning as white as the snow at that booming voice. Snarling, the Ikori grabbed the boy by the shoulders and shook him. A repeat of the demand only terrified the young victim more, and I thrust my way to them.
"Enough!" I shouted. "How can you expect the poor thing to do anything? You're scaring him to death. Let me do it."
The Ikori glowered at me, but waited as I bent down and swiftly unbuttoned the coat.
Nothing to be afraid of, Alan. Let's just get this off so these gentlemen can be on their way. Rather than soothe, my words had an opposite effect. Alan started fighting me, tugging back on the coat.
No, no! My mom made this, and now she's with the angels. They can't have it!
Hush, I said, seeing the big Ikori preparing to intervene. Your ma is in paradise and won't mind. She'll be proud of what a brave and selfless boy you are.
They can't have it!
My heart breaking, I finally wrestled the coat off him and handed it to the Ikori man. As he started to turn around, Alan cried out.
You'll burn in Oziel's hell with all the other infidels. Eliziel will pass his judgment upon you, and all of your descendants will suffer until the end of time.
The Ikori backhanded Alan in one smooth motion, sending the boy flying. The big man's face was red with anger, his nostrils flaring. He stormed to where Alan had landed and reached forward. I inserted myself between them and pushed back on the Ikori's chest.
Tamsin! Exclaimed Gideon.
An Ikori grabbed his arm as he tried to get to me.
Let him go! He's a boy!
I yelled.
You've got the coat and a pretty good haul. No need to drag this on.
The Ikori's eyes still burned with fury, and he didn't budge. I yanked off my mittens.
Here, you missed these. How's that for a prize? Now take what you've got and go home.
He seized the mittens, running his fingers over the beadwork and silky material with approval. When he shoved them into his pocket, I thought the ordeal was finally over. But a few moments later, his gaze fell on Alan again, and the anger rekindled. This time, when the Ikori advanced, I didn't just block his way. I smacked him in the face as hard as I could, landing what was probably a weak blow, save that my nails had drawn blood on his cheek. He dabbed at it disbelievingly, and a few of his comrades snickered. He wiped the blood on his pants and focused back on me.
Poocha, he hissed.
I started at the unexpected insult and then foolishly blurted out. I've been called worse. His hand closed into a fist at the same time a series of shouts sounded in the distance. The Ikori flinched and looked around. At the top of the hill we'd sledded down, the dark shapes of several people appeared. I couldn't make out any faces, but one called clearly, "Everything okay?" Without a word, the Ikori immediately retreated, securing their prizes and mounting their horses. They rode away, and were long gone by the time our unexpected saviors from the Grey Gull's crew reached us. Chapter 16. I never expected to be so grateful to see Captain Milford again. His crew had been living in a makeshift camp on the outskirts of Constancy, and tasked with felling trees for a building project, but our paths never crossed. Although not forbidden, the crew were discouraged from spending too much time in town unless they wanted to attend church services, and Constancy really wasn't the sort of place sailors went to for recreation, anyway. But the townspeople were very interested in the sailors now. After we'd made it back to the square and recounted what had happened, the council called an emergency meeting that was open for all to attend. Word spread quickly, and the church soon filled with almost as many people as I'd seen at the service. All of my glittering court companions came, along with their hosting families, except for Vanessa, whom the Coles still ordered to stay home until her atonement.
They were Ikori, all right, Captain Milford said.
The council had called him to stand by the podium and give his version of what had happened.
We were on our way to the valley to scout tomorrow's job, and that's when we saw them, all wild-eyed and vicious, dressed up in that crazy plaid of theirs. They were waving their weapons around, and I honestly don't know what those poor children would have done if we hadn't swooped in to save them.
Sitting with Gideon on one of the congregation's benches, I tried not to grimace. It was true the sailor's arrival had spurred the Ikori's departure, and I was extremely grateful for that hasty resolution. But the captain and his crew hadn't exactly done much in the way of swooping or saving, certainly not to the heroic extremes they described when testifying. That detail was irrelevant, though. The real issue was assessing if Constancy was in danger or not. They could be on the verge of a full-scale attack, one councilman declared. He gestured for the captain to take a seat. Every family must arm itself, and we need to get word to the fort to send soldiers. Another councilman treaded more cautiously. I don't trust them any more than you do, but one rogue group doesn't mean an attack is coming. They just sound like thieves. But his counterpart insisted, all Ikori are thieves. This could have been a scouting party that saw the children and decided to take advantage of easy pickings. I shifted, trying to get comfortable, as they argued. Hunger gnawed at my belly, and I wished the benches had backs. People were continually arriving, and each time the door opened, a blast of cold air would roll over me. Once I'd given my own account of the events, there was nothing left for me to do but wait quietly and listen. Town policy and defense were male domains, and while plenty of women had turned out tonight, they weren't expected to ask questions or offer suggestions. I didn't have much in the way of suggestions, but I was certainly beginning to build a mental list of questions as time went on. The assault at the pond still seemed surreal. At times, the emotions I'd felt during that terrifying episode would slam into me with full force and clarity. I'd start to sweat, and my pulse would race. Other times, I remembered the events in a manner so detached, it was as though it had happened to someone else instead of me, like it was just a story I was hearing or reading. And in those cooler moments, something about the whole encounter felt off. But I couldn't quite grasp how. After all, it had been straightforward, hadn't it? We'd been robbed by men who looked exactly like what our book said Ikori looked like. But that was what bothered me, because they hadn't looked at all like the Ikori I'd actually met. Off to the church's far side, the children who'd gone sledding sat on the floor. They hadn't testified, but the council wanted them on hand in case any questions arose. They looked even more tired than I felt as they huddled against the wall, and anxiety still filled most of their faces. I wish they could be allowed to go home and be comforted by parents. They should at least get dinner, I muttered. Gideon tilted his head toward me. Hmm? I nodded toward the children and whispered back, I'm sure they're starving. He studied them for several seconds and then, with murmured apologies to those sitting near us, slipped out of the row of benches. He approached a matronly woman standing near the children and said something into her ear. She nodded and left the church, returning 10 minutes later with a basket of bread that she distributed to the grateful little recipients. When Gideon sat beside me again, I flashed him a smile that he answered in kind. With the afternoon's sudden and dramatic turn, memories of its nicer moments had been shoved aside. Now, my mind wandered back to how affectionate Gideon had been with the children. He'd been as considerate of their needs during their play as he was now with their dinner. Growing up, I'd always known I was lucky to have a father like mine. Plenty of the men who'd lived near us loved their families dearly, but they left most child-rearing, especially the emotional aspects, to their wives. But my father, no matter what else might be happening in his world, stayed firmly involved with our lives and needs. Gideon would be the same with his children, I realized. My focus for the last year had been on finding a husband wealthy enough to give Mary the life she deserved. So long as that was secure, I'd accepted that I might not marry for love. I didn't need it, and could be content in a household where my husband liked and respected me. But what about Mary? Was it enough for her to have a stepfather who liked and respected her? Was I making a critical mistake in not making a loving and nurturing stepfather as high a priority as medicine and education? I sighed and tuned back into the deliberations. The door opened again, bringing in a flurry of frigid air, and a pop of red couldn't help but draw the eye in that room full of subdued colours. Jago Robinson shuffled inside and stomped snow off his boots before finding an unobtrusive spot to stand near some farmers. He looked like he hadn't shaved in a couple of days, and his hat had more wrinkles than ever. When had he gotten back? He'd traded his light-hearted countenance for a much grimmer one, and his attention on the debate was hawk-like. Until the fort can send backup, I propose we post sentries of our own around the area. It's not like those children were playing out in the middle of the wilderness. They were barely on the town's outskirts. We can't let the Ikori sneak up so close again.
That declaration from the lead councilman drew clapping and shouts of assent, though one timid man suggested,
"Perhaps we should send a delegation to talk to the Ikori."
A magistrate in the crowd stood up and dismissed that notion with a snort.
"We'd be sending that delegation to suicide, more likely. And what talking could they do? You heard the report. Those brutes could barely string two Ophidian words together. You can't reason with that."
That nagging sense of something being off played at the back of my mind again. Our assailants, Ophidian, had been terrible. I never would have given it a second thought, though, if I hadn't met Orla. She'd spoken our language perfectly. Some of her companions hadn't, but they'd still communicated better than the men I'd encountered today. The magistrate was still going.
"We should spread word of this to other towns and forbid any Ikori from entering Grashand. No more using our roads, no more trade in our towns. Ikori who do should be imprisoned or removed. We need to put an end to these raids, and if it requires more offensive measures, so be it. The Ikori must be stopped."
Over the scattered cheers, a voice suddenly called out,
"Oh, come on. The Ikori never started anything. You're all acting like fools."
The noise faded, and heads turned. The lead councilman pursed his lips in disapproval.
"Those are provocative words, Jacob Robinson. Perhaps you'd like to rephrase them."
The men standing near Jago parted, leaving a space around him that was particularly conspicuous, given how crowded the church was.
"Only if you didn't understand them," Jago replied. "I'm telling you, the Ikori didn't attack today. We have a couple dozen witnesses who say otherwise. But there's no reason for the Ikori to cause trouble. They're content with the treaties, and they comply with them."
Captain Milford, emboldened by his new celebrity status, jumped to his feet.
"Then who did I see in tartan and woad accosting those children out there?"
Jago hesitated. "I'm not sure." A cacophony erupted, equal parts mockery and outrage at Jaco's assertions. The lead councilman banged on the podium with a gavel.
"Order, order!"
When quiet returned, he continued.
"Mr. Robinson, while I am pleased to see you finally step through the door of this church, I think it best you abstain from participating in town matters, especially considering your bias."
My legs seemed to move of their own accord, and I suddenly found myself standing up.
"Mr. Councilman, with all due respect, I think Mr. Robinson may be right."
Two rows ahead of me, Samuel rose, his face dark.
"Tamsin, sit down. Gentlemen, I apologize. The girl is addled and easily influenced. As her guardian, I take full responsibility."
"I am not addled,"
I interrupted. "I just don't think those men we saw were Ikori." Gideon gave my hand a gentle tug.
"Tamsin," he said softly.
Another councilman took up a spot beside the lead one. "Miss Wright, is it? You just testified, under oath to the angels, about what you saw. Everyone heard you describe the tartan, the woad, their crude manner,
because I did see those things, but it wasn't right."
The hostility in the room was growing, and its pressure made me falter.
Like, the way they spoke, it was so broken, almost perfectly so. Every word punctuated too much, like it was being contrived to sound like they didn't know Ophidian.
Samuel, still glowering at me, said,
"Because they don't speak Ophidian. Of course everything is going to be slow and loud. It was a wonder they could utter any words at all."
"Well, they certainly seem to understand Ophidian. One flew into a rage when Alan put down Oziel's curse on him. There are a lot of big words in that. Why would he have gotten so upset if he didn't understand them? And why would he even care, seeing as the Ikori don't believe in Oziel?" Another of the town's ministers, one who served on the council, beckoned Alan forward from the cluster of children.
"Alan Morwell, did you issue Oziel's curse?"
Poor Alan crept forward. As he did, I could see the side of his face was still red
from where the bearded man had struck him. No one, not even the heirs, actually believed speaking Oziel's curse could cause it to come about. But it was considered extremely vile and insulting, especially when uttered by a child.
"I'm sorry, Pa," Alan stammered. "He was taking Ma's coat, and I just got so upset. I didn't think he'd get so mad. I didn't think at all. Oh, you should have seen what a beast he was. He would have ripped me in two if Miss Wright hadn't given him those fancy mittens. And then, when she hit him, I thought he was going to rip her in two. But then the..."
"Enough, enough." Mr. Morwell held up a hand to silence his son. "Sit down. We'll discuss your behavior when we get home tonight." I watched Alan slink back to his spot and hoped I hadn't gotten him in trouble. Turning back to the council, I continued. "Sirs, their tartans weren't right either. They were all ripped up so that their chests were bare in the middle of winter."
"It's what they do," the lead councilman said.
"Everyone's heard of the berserker Ikori running shirtless into battle, impervious to the elements." "They weren't impervious," I said. "I saw them shiver. They were cold. And when I travelled here with the Balanquins, the Ikori in that party didn't bare their chests or arms. They didn't wear tartan at all. They were bundled up sensibly in coats and furs."
"What colour were the tartans?"
The question came from Jago. I met his eyes, again surprised at his serious demeanour. "Two were red, one was green, one was blue," I answered.
"What other colours? The stripes and hashes?"
I can't be certain. It all happened so fast. The red one had yellow lines and green squares, I think. The blue was crossed with white."
"And the green had black checks," supplied Gideon, standing up beside me. "Does that mean anything to you, Mr. Robinson?"
Jago nodded.
"Those are tartans from three different clans. They wouldn't work together for a petty robbery. I mean, yes, I suppose a handful of renegades cast out of their clans could join up. But in that case, they wouldn't be openly advertising those clan colours while committing crimes. It'd be an insult to the clans they came from, and they know they'd be punished even more severely if caught."
The magistrate who'd spoken earlier snickered.
"I think you give the Ikori too much credit, but that's no secret. If I'm following this ludicrous exercise, you and Miss Wright are suggesting these men were not Ikori, that they were imposters dressing in Ikori clothing and pretending to speak like them."
"That seems more likely to me than the original accusation," said Jago. The lead councilman banged his gavel when the crowd started buzzing again.
"Then we're back to Captain Milford's question. If they weren't Ikori, then who do you think they were?"
They were all looking at Jago, but I was the one who supplied the answer.
"When I slapped the one threatening Alan, he called me a name. In Lorandian."
I'd been startled at the time to recognize the name, but it hadn't occurred to me then that I shouldn't have understood it at all, not from an Ikori.
"That's your extraordinary fabrication now."
Mr. Morwell's expression had gone from displaying outrage at my impertinence to derision at what he saw as my lack of intelligence.
"That Lorandians, dressed up as Ikori, robbed you. Young lady, I can't decide if you're just looking for attention or are truly fool enough to believe what you're saying. Gideon, did you hear any Lorandian?"
"No, but I also don't know the language. If Tamsin says she heard it, I believe her."
"You're too trusting," said Samuel.
"I know Lorandian," I exclaimed. "Enough of it, at least. I grew up by a Lorandian baker and had lessons in the Glittering Court."
"Different languages often have words that sound alike."
The lead councilman pushed his glasses up, reminding me of our old history master giving a lecture.
"It's entirely probable that there are many Ikori words that sound like Lorandian, or like Osfridian, or anything. That black stone the Balanquins are always trading is called reed in their language. Completely coincidental that it sounds like our verb, or the name we give the river rushes."
"This was not a coincidence, sir. The word he used was, from his point of view, very applicable."
"And what was this revelatory word?"
asked Mr. Morwell, his voice exasperated. I glanced around uneasily, taking especial note of the children. It was not a, flattering term, sir. I don't think it'd be appropriate to say in a church. Mr. Morwell stalked back to his chair. We're wasting time. What was it, Tamsin? Gideon gave me an encouraging nod. Go ahead. Poocha, I said, scanning the congregation for any sign of recognition. I was certain a number of townspeople knew Larandian, but I doubted any had lived near a hot-tempered baker who was always yelling at his wife. I heard a startled exclamation from behind me and wasn't surprised that Damaris knew the word. What's it mean? Prompted Gideon. I cringed under the weight of those gazes. I'd said far worse things in my life, but never in front of an audience like this. After a deep breath and a silent prayer for forgiveness, I blurted out, "It means bitch in Larandian." I couldn't have elicited more outrage than if I'd started knocking over benches and punching people around me. The lead councilman had to practically bang his gavel to splinters before the outcry finally faded. When Samuel ordered me to sit down again, I did. There really wasn't anything else I could add. Incredibly, no one discussed what I'd said. The council started talking centuries again, with the lead councilman saying, "Now, if we can move past this nonsense, let's start taking action before it's too late. We'll need volunteers to ride out to the fort in the morning, as well as to piety and reserve. Men willing to stand watch around our perimeters should meet me when we adjourn, and anyone who needs a gun should..." Didn't you hear any of that? Jago broke from the throng and strode up to the podium, an action that was received with as much shock as my interruptions. "Those were imposters. If you start harassing real Ikori and encouraging military interference, you're just going to escalate an already tense situation. They're the ones who escalated things. Not just here. We all heard about the raids earlier this winter." "That wasn't them either," Jago insisted. "The Larandians are doing this." Mr. Morwell threw up his hands in disgust. "To what end? We've always had troubled relations with the Larandians, but their numbers in Adoria are too small to be any threat, and they know it. And I really don't consider one girl's vile language to stand as proof that those men were Larandian, when all other evidence points to the contrary. Really, Mr. Robinson, if you're so partial to the Ikori, perhaps you'd be better off with them." "I'll go to them right now and arrange talks, if you'd like," Jago returned evenly. "We've already discussed the futility of that. Now, are you quite done wasting our time? You've never shown any interest in being part of this town before, and I'm honestly a bit suspicious as to why you'd start now." Jago's jaw was clenched, and I could see his internal struggle to restrain both words and actions. A stillness fell as everyone waited to see what he'd do, but after several tense moments, he swallowed his temper and marched out of the church without a word. The council continued with its plans and adjourned shortly thereafter to form volunteer committees. Families began to leave, and I stood up and stretched, grateful to be moving. I walked over to the children to check on Alan's injury. He assured me he was fine, and then I stepped outside to get some air. Cold or not, I needed it after the suffocating church. Gideon followed me, and we stood off to the side of the door, our breath making wispy clouds in the crisp evening air. "What do you think of all of this?" I asked. "I don't know," he admitted. "If they really were Larandian brigands, it seems like they could rob people without all the theatre. But I also believe you're right."
"Really? About which part?"
My surprise brought on a wan smile. "All of it. I trust you on the language, and I didn't even consider all those little inconsistencies until you mentioned them. How you managed to be so observant and so brave during all of that is beyond me. I think I was more impulsive than brave. I could have made things a lot worse." I rubbed my hands together, reflecting on those moments. "I didn't think. I was just worried about Alan." "My heart nearly stopped when you went after that man, you know. Even now, it gives me chills just thinking how something could have gone horribly wrong for you, or the children." Serious or not, I couldn't resist.
Are you sure it's that giving you chills, and not the weather?
All I could do out there was pray to the angels when you were facing that man down. Of course, you got enough divine favor that you probably didn't even need my intervention.
He clasped my freezing hands in his gloved ones. What you do need, however, are mittens. But we should be able to manage that without prayer. I don't know. I'll be going on my third pair. The angels might cut me off.
We stood together in comfortable silence, enjoying a rare minute or so of peace.
Then a sharp voice said, Tamsin Wright, I pray daily to be worthy of the challenges laid upon me, and it's clear I'm being tested today.
I sprang back from Gideon and saw Dinah silhouetted in the doorway.
Hello, I said, as she stepped out to join us. She looked between me and him with an appraising eye.
You know, she continued, if I hadn't witnessed that outburst and offensive language myself, I wouldn't have believed even someone like you was capable of it.
Gideon put a hand on my shoulder.
Dinah, I know a few, inappropriate things took place tonight, but considering the extraordinary circumstances, I would humbly counsel leniency.
Dinah stiffened as her eyes tracked his hand. She had to wet her lips a few times before continuing.
Gideon, you're always so kind-hearted, but it's my job to shape her character. And now I've just heard the most confusing thing. Alan Morwell was telling me about those fancy mittens of yours, Tamsin. He said they were jewel-encrusted, and I told him that was nonsense. Was he lying?
No, I said swiftly. Well, that is, he was a bit mistaken. They had silver beads on them, not jewels.
Why weren't you wearing your other mittens? The grey ones?
I lost them on one of my errands.
I see. And where did you get these fancy replacements?
I swallowed, unwilling to sell out Jago.
From our luggage. Our luggage from the ship, I mean. Some of it's being kept in the meeting house, and I took the mittens while we were holding class there today.
I see, Dinah repeated, though her hard eyes said much more.
There you all are.
Samuel walked out of the church, Damaris and Winifred behind him. He waved for us to follow.
Time to go.
Our party rode home without conversation, and I stared off into the darkness, apprehensive about both my fate and the Ikoris. It was horrifying to think one incident could trigger a war, except it wasn't just one incident. Other towns had had run-ins with Ikori, and Orla had insisted her people had been attacked without provocation too. Speaking of Orla, how would these new developments affect my own travel plans? Would she take back her offer? Would the Gratian settlers even allow us to go with the Ikori, if they were deemed an official enemy? Of course, until I talked to Jago, I didn't know if I even had travel plans. We ate a sparse dinner of cold leftovers, and then, after a brief prayer, my friends and I were sent off to the attic while Samuel, Gideon, and Dinah had a meeting by the fire. I climbed the stairs with a heavy heart, knowing my future was on the line. The next morning, when we assembled for breakfast, Dinah told me,
You're lucky. Gideon spoke up for you and convinced us to overlook your breach of etiquette in church last night, seeing as it was part of an investigation.
Gideon, already sitting at the table, didn't really look like someone who'd achieved a victory. As I moved to take my own seat, Dinah held up a hand to stop me.
That does not, however, excuse you from the transgressions of theft, vanity, deceit, and negligence.
Me? It was the only thing I could think to say, seeing as she seemed to have mixed me up with someone else. Dinah ticked off my charges with her fingers.
Negligence, for losing your mittens. Deceit, for not confessing it. Vanity, for wearing such garish replacements. And theft, for stealing them.
How can it be theft when it was our own stuff?
That cargo was off limits to you, said Samuel harshly. It's currently in our possession.
That makes it theft.
I looked between the two of them in disbelief.
That's absurd, and you know it.
Dinah pointed at my chair.
Take that over to the stove and wait until the rest of us finish. You won't be eating this morning.
I opened my mouth to protest and then thought better of it. Fine. If they were going to make me skip breakfast because of some trumped-up charges, I'd do it with dignity. I'd show them how a person with principles and strength really behaved. But, oh, I was hungry. The Coles carried on like it was an ordinary day, though everyone else at the table wore a glum look.
I read through your sermon on integrity, Samuel mentioned to Gideon. It's some of your finest work.
Thank you, mumbled Gideon, eyes on his food.
I liked the way you explained how deception casts a shadow on families and communities. But, for the most part, your sermon only focuses on how things like honesty and honor improve lives. Maybe consider adding in a passage from the punishment of King Linus to show where deceit leads.
Gideon's eyebrows rose. King Linus died in a pit of scorpions.
Exactly. It's important to motivate people.
I wanted badly to speak to Gideon about what had happened last night, and also to see if he could contrive any last-minute intervention before Vanessa's punishment tomorrow. Dinah went to town with us, however, and I had no chance at privacy. Gideon parted from us in the square after giving me a long, searching look. I responded with a pained smile and then turned toward the school.
No, you're not going there today, said Dinah.
Am I back to doing laundry? Damaris and Winifred had gone off to their usual assignments, but maybe someone else had been recruited for Vanessa's former spot.
No, come with me.
Dinah walked briskly across the square with a self-satisfaction I found unnerving. I followed her to a residential section and watched with growing dread as she knocked on the door of one of the larger houses. A woman I recognized in passing but hadn't met answered and urged us inside. No introductions were made, and I wondered if I had been assigned to help her. But as we passed through the exceptionally well-kept home, it didn't look as though she needed much in the way of chores done. At last, we reached the far side of the house, and I stepped into a room that appeared to be an addition to the original building. It had walls that were still rough and unfinished, and a dirt floor scattered with hay. A narrow, rectangular window near the ceiling provided lighting in the same way the church's windows did. This window was covered in greased paper instead of glass, however, creating a more muted illumination. I took the strange room in and asked, "What is..." The door slammed behind me. I was alone.
Chapter 17. I dove for the doorknob, but it was locked. "What's going on? What is this?"
I pounded on the door until splinters made me stop.
"This is your home for the next 4 days," Dinah called from the other side. "Your place of solace, to contemplate your wicked acts and pray for forgiveness. You didn't really think foregoing breakfast was the only penance you'd pay for those mittens, did you?"
"Penance for mittens!"
I kicked the door a few times.
"Do you hear yourself? You can't leave me in an empty room for 4 days over a pair of mittens.
2 pairs, technically. And the fact that you don't realize how grave the situation is simply confirms why you should be here."
"I want to talk to Gideon. He wouldn't allow this."
He'd been subdued at breakfast, but I was positive he couldn't have known this was coming. He wouldn't have just sat there without protest.
"Gideon can't help you, and once you've served your time, we're moving you to another house so that you won't be able to corrupt him with your seductive wiles anymore."
"My seductive..." I couldn't even stand to repeat it.
"Everything you'll need is there. That's all the food and water you'll get, so ration wisely. You have books to inspire you and help contemplate the errors of your ways, so use them. If you've written a satisfactory confession and appeal for forgiveness, you'll be allowed to go home in 4 days. You'll then be confined to your new residence until the next holy day."
Just like Vanessa, except I'd earned an extra day. I closed my eyes and leaned against the wall, knowing what Dinah would say next. Or, at least, I thought I knew.
You'll sit outside the church before services with a sign proclaiming your guilt. Later, you'll read your confession to the congregation, after which point you'll remove your sign.
There was a pause.
And then you'll have your hair shorn.
I bolted upright.
What? Vanessa didn't have to do that.
Vanessa wasn't guilty of vanity. And this way, it'll be a little more difficult for you to tempt innocent men.
Is that what this is bloody about? You being jealous of how Gideon feels about me? That he's interested in me?
Don't make it sound like he has a choice. You've used some sort of beguiling, or whatever it is you learn at that school of yours.
He'd never give you a second look if you hadn't muddled his mind. And I'm going to free him from you.
Well, I've got some bad news for you. Getting me out of your house and cutting my hair isn't going to make him fall in love with you. Nothing short of a miracle will, so maybe you'd better start copying some passages and see if you can shore up some goodwill with the angels.
There was a much, much longer pause. Then, see you in 4 days.
Wait! I beat on the door again. Splinters be damned.
I didn't seduce anyone! You can't do this! Not over mittens!
The silence that answered eventually convinced me that Dinah and the lady of the house had left. I raked a hand through my hair, which was apparently on borrowed time, and began pacing the small space. When Vanessa had been taken away, Samuel had said she had modest accommodations. Well, here they were. My 4 days' worth of rations consisted of 4 slices of bread and a tub of water. A chamber pot sat in a corner of the room. In the opposite one, several holy texts were stacked neatly beside paper, pen, and ink. That was it. Nothing to sleep on. Nothing to warm me beyond the clothes I already wore. And with no candle or lantern, my light would depend on the sun shining through the window. Famished from missing breakfast, I quickly ate a piece of bread and almost grabbed another without thinking. No, I dropped my hand. If they were really going to leave me here for 4 days, I'd have to be careful with it and the water. In fact, I should have eaten only half a piece and saved the rest for tonight. I took a few sips of water and vowed to ignore the bread until tomorrow. But what to do now? I couldn't bring myself to write that damned confession. What would they do to me if it wasn't ready in time? Give me another 4 days' worth of meager supplies? Leave me to starve? I kicked at the wall in frustration, lost over what I should do. I'd put up with so much inconstancy. I thought I'd been patient. I thought I'd been reasonable, more than reasonable, really. And where had that left me? I spent most of the day oscillating between despair and rage. I'd slump to the ground and curl up into myself, wishing I'd never set foot in Adoria or heard of the glittering court. But with enough time, I'd get fired up again and walk the little room, shouting and banging. Based on the house's orientation on the square, it seemed unlikely anyone would hear me. This room was in the back, and the building was long. In fact, recalling the larder and hall I'd passed through to get here, I doubted even the house's residents would hear me. At last, as the light began to fade, I finally made use of the paper to write a letter to Mary. I tucked it into my pocket when I finished, allowed myself one bite of tomorrow's bread, and then watched the room sink into darkness. The dirt floor bothered me less than the chill did. The room had no insulation, and gaps in the paper window sill let the wind sneak in. I gathered what hay I could around me, and slept huddled against the wall shared with the rest of the house. I woke frequently throughout the night, reaching for a blanket that wasn't there. I arose cold and sore the next morning, watching as my breath made clouds in the air. Vanessa would likely be sitting outside the church by now. The brightness of the paper window suggested a clear day, so at least she wouldn't have to endure rain or snow. The bitter overnight wind had faded too, and I felt like I was keeping watch with her as I hunched in a corner,
and rubbed my hands together. When I finally heard the church bell ring, I breathed a small sigh of relief. At least that phase of her punishment was over. Now she just had to get through her confession. If there was any positive side to my confinement, it was that I wouldn't have to witness her admitting guilt for taking a book she hadn't actually taken. I didn't know if I could have sat there and endured it. I very likely might have rushed to her side and raged at the crowd. Was that what I'd do when my time came? Would I stand there and rail at them for their hypocritical, close-minded ways? Or would I, too, submit, meekly doing as I was told, in order to get another day closer to Cape Triumph, another day closer to Mary? A moment of humiliation before people I'd never see again was a small price to reunite with my daughter. Even cutting my hair was. Except I was certain that bit had been a personal addition of Dinah's. I'd heard accusations of vanity constantly since being here, but no one else was walking around with shorn hair. Another long day dragged by. I raged a little less, lethargic now from lack of food and sleep. I wrote a letter to Mary again, but made no attempt at penning a confession. I wouldn't have minded reading the books to pass the time, but I resisted out of spite. The third day passed more quickly, largely because I kept spacing out. Deprivation and cold had sapped my strength, moving me from tired to exhausted. My thoughts were dull, and sometimes standing up too quickly would make me dizzy. I didn't have the energy to write to Mary, and I knew I should work on the confession while I still had some sense. But I never picked up the pen. "Why? What are you proving?" I asked myself when twilight fell. I lay on the floor, hands behind my head, watching shadows play about the room. "Suck up your pride, confess, cut your hair and keep moving. It's the only way to marry." No, it wasn't. I might still have Jago and the Ikori, but I wouldn't know for sure until I got out of here. And to do that, I'd have to play Dinah's game. Or would I? Slowly, I sat up and studied the window. It was too high for me to reach. There were no handholds on the wall. There was nothing I could stack to climb on. But I could fit through that window. I thought about that as dusk gave way to night. Moonlight just barely kept the window aglow, which hadn't happened the last two nights. They must have been cloudy. The rest of the room was still hard to see, and I moved slowly around it, feeling and assessing my accoutrements. I had the beginnings of a plan forming in my head, one that would make things go from bad to worse if it failed. "But it won't," I murmured, taking off my cloak. I gritted my teeth against the cold and gripped the fabric tightly, trying to tear it. It held fast, as I'd expected, so I used the pen to stab at the cloak, creating holes to give me traction. Slowly, painstakingly, I tore the wool into strips about 2 inches wide. After that, I began disassembling the skirt of my overdress. I ripped 2/3 of it into more fabric strips before determining I had enough. I tied them all together, end to end, and felt pretty proud of the length of rope I'd created. But the exertion had taken its toll. I gave in to a brief break to regain my strength and brazenly ate all of my remaining bread. Then it was back to work. With apologies to the angels, I started hurling holy texts at the window. Some missed, a couple bounced off the greased paper, but one struck in exactly the right way. Its corners tore the paper, creating a small hole. From there, it turned out to be relatively easy to expand the hole and knock out most of the paper. When I was satisfied with the opening, I tossed all the remaining books outside. That required another rest. When I could drag myself up from it, I took one last deep drink of the water and then dumped the tub out. Water spilled over the hay and dirt, and I winced at the waste. Then I tied an end of the fabric rope through one of the tub's handles. The tub was narrow and oval-shaped.
If the long side was horizontally oriented to the window, the tub would fit through the opening. If perpendicular, it wouldn't. My first dozen attempts to throw the tub out the window failed. Most didn't get high enough. When I did manage a toss that reached the right height, the tub had rotated and couldn't fit through. I stopped to rest at that point, crouching on the muddied floor. The room wavered. My muscles were fatigued. With great effort, I forced myself up and resumed my task. After a few more bad throws, I finally got everything right, and the tub sailed out. The victory didn't last, though, because when I began reeling the rope in, the tub came right back in with it. This certainly wasn't how I'd imagined my makeshift grappling hook working, and each failure was noisy, since it meant the metal tub had struck the wall. I fully expected detection from someone inside or outside the house. But finally, the tub landed outside a second time, and this time I pulled it up slowly, making sure it stayed angled in a way that didn't immediately make it slip back in. When the tub was secured crosswise against a corner of the window and didn't return when tugged, I cautiously climbed up the rope and tumbled ungracefully out the window. I landed hard in the snow, which was a foot deeper than it had been when I'd come here. The tub crashed down beside me, and I flipped it over as I surveyed the scattered books. I really had no use for them, but it seemed a shame to leave them behind. I also didn't want any of my escape tools discovered. Using the tub as a basket, I piled the texts and rope into it, and then tried to stand. Everything spun around me, and I had to quickly grab the house to keep from falling. I closed my eyes, drawing breath and centering myself. Stay strong, Tamsin. You aren't beaten yet. Clutching at whatever scraps of reserve energy I could, I lifted the tub and set out. It had to be the middle of the night by that point. I expected easy passage through Constancy and was surprised to spy a few men out and about. Sentries watching for Ikori, I realized. Evading them took a little care, but wasn't too difficult. And once I was well along the creek road, I never saw anyone else. I had little sense of time or scenery on the trip. Everything within me was focused on continuing along the road. One more step. One more step. Over and over, I told myself that. My limbs grew heavy, and I had trouble walking in a straight line. I constantly corrected myself, and more than once, I tripped and sent books flying. So many times I wanted to stop, but feared I'd never get going again. So on I went, driven by thoughts of Mary and a warm fire and spiting Dinah. If clouds had hidden the gibbous moon, I might not have found Jago's property in my adult state. But the two barns stood out starkly in the pale light, and I pushed through the chill and fatigue to quicken my pace to the dark little house. I gave the door three sharp raps and then waited, my teeth chattering. "Who's there?" came a muffled voice. "Tamsin." A long silence followed, and I closed my eyes, thinking I might very well fall asleep there. Jago finally opened the door with a lantern in hand, just as a voice behind me barked, "Freeze!" "Everything's all right, Arno," said Jago. He studied me in the lantern's golden light, and I'd say she's already freezing. Jolted to alertness, I turned and found the big Belgian man behind me. He walked around the porch, a rifle in hand. When he recognized me, he immediately lowered the gun.
"Miss Tamsin, I did not know you."
Jago steered me inside. "It's okay. You can go back to the barn. And thank you." A banked fire glowed orange in Jago's hearth, and I headed straight for it, dropping the tub along the way. I felt numbed and stupid, and even when I sank to my knees, the world kept wobbling and spinning. If I could just get warm, I could think clearly. I leaned in closer to the fire,
its heat slowly spreading over my skin. After my last few stark days of existence, the glowing flames seemed almost friendly, like long-time acquaintances welcoming me home.